de l'âge, des âges. Et je ne dirais pas que nous avons des vieux et des jeunes, mais je dirais simplement que nous avons un bel éventail des âges qui s'étage agréablement jusqu'à la jeune Emily Neumeier, qui va maintenant vous parler, qui est historienne de l'art, que j'ai connue, que j'ai eu le plaisir de connaître il y a de cela quelques années, alors qu'elle faisait encore ses études à l'université de Pennsylvanie. Aux États-Unis. Elle est aujourd'hui professeure, maître assistant à la Tyler School of Art de Temple University à Philadelphie, l'université du Temple, ça fait rêver. C'est une spécialiste de l'art et de l'architecture dans le monde musulman. Et elle met un accent particulier sur le bassin oriental de la Méditerranée, donc les territoires ottomans. Ses travaux ont porté, et elle en parlera aujourd'hui même, sur des cas de collectionneurs, d'antiquaires ou en tout cas d'intervenants dans le jeu archéologique de ottoman pendant la fin et du XVIIIe siècle et le début du XIXe. Elle a aussi travaillé sur un sujet qui est fort différent mais qui se recoupe un peu puisqu'elle a travaillé sur les musées grecs d'aujourd'hui et sur la gestion qu'ils ont de l'histoire et du patrimoine ottoman. Vaste sujet, peut-être le sujet d'un colloque futur, mais pour le moment, je l'invite donc à parler des rivaux d'Elgin. Nous venons de voir Elgin et ses artistes. Emily Neumeier va parler des rivaux locaux d'Elgin et notamment de certains pachas et notabilités ottomanes en Morée, qui ont apparemment participé au grand jeu de l'archéologie. Je l'invite donc à nous présenter son intervention.
So,
ce sera en anglais, vous pouvez donc suivre la traduction avec votre casque.
So first of all, I'd like to thank Ed Hameldam for inviting me to this conference, to this colloquium. As you will see in my research, I have engaged with the work of many scholars who are also speaking today, so I'm very pleased to be here. Now, as you would gather from my title, we're going to spend most of our time today in the Morea, in the Greek Peloponnese. But first, we're going to make a stop at the British Museum. Where else? And in the ancient sculpture galleries, today's visitor may encounter this monumental facade, the portal of the so-called Treasury of Atreus, Atholo's tomb originally constructed between 1350 and 1250 BCE in Mycenae. Now in London, the museum curators have employed a minimalist display to emphasize the two ornamented columns that once framed the doorway of the burial chamber. Similar to other examples of sculpted marble situated in adjacent galleries, these fragmented columns serve as didactic objects, imparting knowledge about the impressive building practices of the Bronze Age Mediterranean. Yet this architectural sculpture also stands as the material evidence of another moment in history, the early days of modern archaeology, when, in the early 19th century, a great number of these old stones first arrived in Western Europe. More specifically, the columns from Mycenae are significant in that they speak to an aspect of the history of archaeology that is often overlooked, the role of local actors in the appreciation and acquisition of such objects. For these columns were not first uncovered by the likes of Lord Elgin, but by another individual whose name is barely known today, Veli Pasha, the Ottoman governor of the Morea. So Veliuddin Pasha, Veli to his friends, was the eldest son of Tepedelenli Ali Pasha, who ruled over what is now northern Greece and southern Albania for over 30 years. Velli was raised to follow in his father's footsteps, and in 1807, he was appointed governor general, the title is Velli, to the Ottoman province of the Morea. So just to give you a sense of the map here, so these are the different places we'll be going during my presentation. It's quite unusual. I cannot find any images of Velli Pasha. There are dozens of images of his father, so I'm using this kind of silly European tapestry of Ali Pasha and his sons, supposedly. I mean, it's very Orientalist, but it gives you some idea and some ability to put a name, a face to the name. And if anything, this tapestry, of course, shows how important Ali Pasha and Velli Pasha were to European imagination, not only the Ottoman imaginaire. So, and also, just to give some local color, I suppose, I wanted to show you his full title and name in Ottoman Turkish. This is from an Ottoman document regarding commissioning of a mosque in the Peloponnese, which is interesting. So that gives you an idea. And also with this map, what I really want to emphasize, of course, is that Ali Pasha and Velli Pasha, father and son, and we're essentially in charge of most of what is today Greece at this time period, the early 19th century, with the notable exceptions of Athens, Thessaloniki, and the Ionian Islands, which in a complicated and not unrelated situation was bitterly being fought over at this exact point between the Ottomans, the Russians, the British, and the French. So this gives you the lay of the land. Now stationed at his post in Tripoli, Velli Pasha found himself in the midst of what has been memorably described as a scramble for the past, when the territories ruled by the Ottoman Empire emerged as one of the primary arenas for European archaeological exploration. It seems that the governor likewise came down with an acute case of marble fever. He became directly involved in some of the most significant discoveries of the day, including excavations at Mycenae. The case of Velli Pasha lies at the juncture of two fields of scholarship, namely Ottoman history and the history of archaeology. Recent publications examining what we could call Ottoman antiquarianism in the 18th and early 19th centuries, precisely when Velli Pasha was active, primarily looked to evaluate indigenous and alternative archaeologies, investigating how non-elite inhabitants coexisted with and interpreted the past. And of course, I'm referring to the work of my colleague Yannis Hamalakis and Benjamin Anderson. As I presume we will hear more about shortly, competing discourses between the pre-modern archaeology of local inhabitants and the modern archaeology of European foreigners often led to clashes over ancient sculpture. Velli Pasha represents a third group of stakeholders who played an important role in these cross-cultural, trans-imperial encounters, Ottoman provincial elites. Velli Pasha's high political status as governor of the Morea province also reminds us that while the European travelers who came to this region in the 18th and 19th centuries were a relatively small group of men with a similar education and class background, the locals whom they encountered could hardly be subsumed under a single language, class, or creed. Rather, the inhabitants of the area under question made up an entire social and political ecosystem that was distinctively Ottoman. It is important to delineate the social stratigraphy and political hierarchies in operation within the Ottoman Empire during the earliest days of classical archaeology, because there is a vast difference between how ordinary people versus the more educated elites approached the ancient past, even though both discourses could be considered emic or local. While the non-elite inhabitants of the region maintained a more vernacular view to the materiality and temporality of antiquity, governors such as Velli Pasha and his father, Ali Pasha, took up antiquarian practices of excavation and collecting that were not only provoked by the arrival of European archaeologists, but also fueled by the more long-standing intellectual interests of the members of the so-called Greek Enlightenment at their own courts. What's more, Velli Pasha deviates from the common portrait of Ottoman officials in this period, characterized as generally indifferent to the European interest in locating and exporting ancient materials. Veli Pasha did not object to European archaeologists working in the area under his jurisdiction. If anything, he encouraged them, but he was hardly indifferent to the enterprise, content to observe from the sidelines. Rather than leave the business of excavations to foreign antiquarians, Veli Pasha got caught up himself in the hunt for ancient sculpture and, most significantly, initiated his own archaeological investigations. It was at Mycenae that Veli Pasha made one of his first forays into archaeology. Archival sources confirm that in the summer of 1810, Veli Pasha was hard at work at the site, primarily engaged in excavating a Tholos tomb, the same monument today known as the Treasury of Atreus. Lord Elgin himself had ordered a first round of exploratory excavations of this tomb beginning in 1802, but by the time Veli Pasha arrived, the entranceway had been filled in again, which I think you can see here. Veli had this entire area cleared, in the process finding more pieces from the two half columns of green marble that decorated the entrance. These are the architectural fragments that can now be seen on display at the British Museum. Before the columns arrived in London, however, they underwent a circuitous journey. Just a few weeks after Veli Pasha's excavations, Peter Brown, the Marquess of Sligo, arrived in Tripoli to pay his respects to the Ottoman governor at his official residence. Veli Pasha received Lord Sligo cordially, and as was common at such meetings, the vizier and his guest exchanged gifts. Lord Sligo offered Veli Pasha two large cannons that were being held on his ship, and in return, the governor presented a set of guns, a gold embroidered costume in the Albanian style, a horse, and two ancient columns, which he said would last longer than the horse or clothes would. So he had a sense of humor. Lord Sligo ultimately transported the columns back to his estate in Ireland. There, they were eventually forgotten and left to linger until 1904, when they were located by the Marquess's grandson and donated to the British Museum. Veli Pasha not only exposed the interior and entranceway to the Treasury of Atreus, but he also broke ground on another nearby tumulus, quite likely at the advice of William Gell, a British artist and antiquarian, who, reading the ancient Greek geographer Pausanias, predicted the presence of another tomb outside of the city walls. In the end, the governor opened a trench and located another, smaller Tholos tomb, what is now known as the Tomb of Clytemnestra, which Heinrich Schliemann went on to excavate more thoroughly in the 1870s. The fact that Gell may have guided Veli Pasha's excavations points to an interesting inversion of the roles that one typically sees in narratives of colonial, or in this case, crypto-colonial encounter. Instead of the indigenous population serving as informants or guides to the colonial explorer, here it is the European visitor who guides the local governor in his archaeological pursuits. Shortly before his time in Mycenae, Veli Pasha had also commenced digging in the nearby village of Argos in the early summer of 1810 in the ancient Agora. It was here that Veli Pasha, governor of the Morea, caused an excavation to be made near the theater and discovered 16 marble statues and busts in good style and preservation, particularly one of Venus and another of Asclepius. They were not quite half the size of life. Similar to his efforts at Mycenae, Veli Pasha also employed the services of an Englishman, unfortunately unnamed in the sources, who assisted the governor with drawing up an itemized register of all of the major finds at Argos. This register is now lost, but it was seen by William Gell in 1810, who mentioned it in his own travel account. "I saw a list of statues found by an English gentleman in company with Veli Pasha on the eastern coast of Laconia on the borders of Argolis, which, though highly ludicrous in itself, from the pompous style in which the several fragments were set forth, was sufficient to show that the field was very productive. This list began in full-mouthed Greek, 1 Venus, without a head, 1 draped Minerva, without head, arms, or feet, 1 Apollo, wanting one leg, etc., etc." Unfortunately, we know little about the current whereabouts of these sculptures, although there was a clue from a letter that Lord Elgin received from one of his agents in September 1810, stating that Veli had sold some sculptures from Argos to Messrs. Knight and Fazakerley. This is no doubt a reference to Henry Galley Knight and John Nicholas Fazakerley, who traveled together to Greece in 1810. It is tempting to link Veli Pasha's finds in the theater of Argos with a Hellenistic statue of a marble core now located at the British Museum, which was donated by Knight and Fazakerley in 1818. The sculpture fits the description of what Gell refers to as a statue of a draped Minerva having lost its head, arms, and feet, and being not quite half the size of life at a height of 0.54 meters. North and Fazakerley first saw the statues that Veli Pasha had found at Argos in the governor's palace in Tripoli, situated in a long passage where Veli said he kept sculpture that he collected for his English friends. Knight and Fazakerley bought the whole lot of statues for the sum of £500. After having exported these sculptures back to the United Kingdom, shortly thereafter, with the assistance of one of the Pasha's agents, they donated one of their purchases to the British Museum. And I also have tantalizing details about a statue, about the Apollo statue that's mentioned here. There's another string of documents that says that Veli Pasha sent a statue of the Apollo in the style of the Belvedere, which he found at Argos, and gifted it to one of the physicians in the court, in his father's court in Ioannina, supposedly a Frenchman. I'd like to think that it made its way to France, but I really have no idea. And if anybody has any clues, I would be appreciative. Veli Pasha at first concentrated his energy on exploring the ancient remains of the Argolid, with his men moving from site to site, likely following tips or advice from villagers who volunteered information once they learned the vizier was interested. Yet perhaps the most intriguing offer for locating antiquities presented itself about a year later, in the early days of the summer of 1812, this time on the opposite side of the Morea in the western mountains of Arcadia. It was around this time that George Gropius appeared in the governor's court to procure permission to excavate the temple of Apollo Epicurus at Bassae. Gropius was representing the loosely formed Society of Friends, a mixed group of European antiquarians who had met in Athens and decided to pool their resources in their mutual mission to locate, document, and ideally extricate ancient sculpture from Ottoman lands. Fresh from successfully excavating a series of spectacular marbles from Aegina, which eventually found their way to the Glyptothek in Munich, the same group decided to head to the remote mountains of the western Peloponnese in search of Bassae, a temple said to have been built by Ictinos, the architect of the Athenian Parthenon. After an initial reconnaissance and drawing survey in 1811, they decided to return the following year to excavate, which is how Gropius found his way to Veli Pasha's court. To the great annoyance of the aspiring excavators, the governor was not satisfied with the standard remuneration that was usually offered by Europeans in exchange for an order, a permission, a boiuroldu, but was only willing to grant the permission to dig if he could join the mission as a financial backer and stakeholder. In exchange for providing half of the excavation costs upfront, Veli Pasha was promised half of the archaeological material, by which was meant the figural sculpture, that would be found, with the Europeans retaining the right of the first refusal to purchase the governor's share of the marbles at the conclusion of the dig. Because the temple was situated in a remote mountain location, the governor of the Morea was not able to join Gropius and the rest of the team for the excavations at Bassae, so he sent one of his agents, a Greek-speaking Christian by the name of Vasilakis, to represent him and his interests at the site. Vasilakis took up the job of paying the local workers coming from the nearby village. He was responsible for maintaining a register of names and working hours of the men. Bronsted writes, "This task, which certainly was not without its difficulties, has been assigned to him for two reasons, partly to keep him occupied because he was miserably bored and completely incapable of taking part in our delight in the marble Amazons and heroes who day by day were descending in greater numbers to us from the night of the past, partly because of prudence which other circumstances imposed. Since the Pasha's own participation in our undertaking could not be avoided, His Highness would, of course, be more likely to trust the information given in the report on the expenses incidental to the excavation project if the most important of these passed through the hands of his own servant." The European archaeologist clearly resented Vasilakis for his position of power, as his mission of surveillance provided a constant reminder that they were only there by the goodwill of the governor. This situation naturally bred insecurity among the foreign antiquarians, and Bronsted reacted by belittling the Pasha's agent in his account as completely indifferent to the antiquities being unearthed at the temple, unworthy, as it were, of wisdom descending from the night of the past. The Danish archaeologist also leveled similar accusations. Also leveled similar accusations at Veli Pasha himself. How the excavation progressed had presumably been already reported from time to time to the Pasha by his servant, Vasilaki. But the incompleteness of this ignorant person's reports, or the Pasha's own unimaginative ignorance, or both in conjunction, were no doubt the reason why the Pasha made known to us his most inconvenient demand of having a great many of the recovered idols, as they were termed, brought to him in Tripolitsa, where it would please his highness to inspect them personally. The unpleasant demand could not but be complied with, whence a number of damaged Amazons and centaurs, carefully packed and transported by 7 or 8 mules, had to make their way well over a day's journey to Tripolitsa and back again to the temple. However, the traveling excursion of the fragmentary heroes did no doubt result in one good thing, namely that the Pasha, who presumably did not feel too well at ease in this idle chaos, became more inclined to renounce his share in the discoveries against a sum of money. This disparagement of Veli Pasha as ignorant and incapable of appreciating the wonders of antiquity is also picked up by Charles Cockerell, who was part of the initial 1811 survey of the site, but could not be present for the excavations the following summer. He recalls that Veli Pasha, the governor of the Morea, has sanctioned the explorations on the understanding that he should have half profits. But when he had seen the sculptures, he was so disappointed that they were not gold or silver, and so little understood them, that he took the warriors under shields for tortoises, allowing that as such, they were rather well done. And I can't, I mean, I hear some pictures of the frieze. I have a feeling these are the some of the pieces that he saw and he was talking about. Deploying a rhetoric of the ignorant native is a well-established tactic of 18th and 19th century European travelers. It is easy to imagine that Veli Pasha in particular was seen as a threat by the likes of Bronsted or Cockerell due to a special interest in ancient sculpture. Surely one of the reasons the Bassi team opted to ship to the governor in Tripoli some of the more damaged sculptures, besides minimalizing the risk of breakage for the choicer marbles, was because they did not want Veli Pasha, who after his previous experiences clearly held the capacity to judge the quality of ancient marbles, to decide that he wanted to keep his share of the finds. To their relief, the European excavators were ultimately able to buy Veli Pasha out. The collection was then put up for an open auction in Zakynthos, where it was ultimately sold to the British Museum, to the British Crown, thus securing the famous temple frieze for the British Museum. Shortly after the excavations at Bassi, Veli Pasha was removed from his position in the Morea and transferred north to serve as the governor of Larissa. In his new post, the governor continued to keep himself abreast of all developments with regards to locating ancient materials. In a letter dated 1818, the British diplomat Arthur Carrigan recalled a meeting that he had with the governor during his journey through the area. "The example of excavating which I thought had originated with Ali Pasha was, it seems, set to him by this son, Veli, who made considerable excavations in the Morea, his former pashalik. Among the objects of the fine arts, he found 4 statues or busts, which he presented to Lord Guildford then. Mr. North and I were surprised to find he recollected the names of the deities and personages represented by these stones. He also gave a good account of some of the same reliefs still in his own possession, and which he calls quadri in marmor, or pictures in marble. He is a handsome man of very agreeable cast of countenance and possessed of considerable powers of conversation." From Kerrigan's statement, we can gather a number of important points. First, it seems that the governor continued to keep a collection of marbles for himself in Thessaly. Second, the fact that the governor could recall in great detail the statues he had located in Argos several years ago calls into question the claims of the foreign excavators at Bassi that Veli Pasha was unfamiliar with and even resistant to the concept of figural sculpture on any grounds of religion or superstition. So what do we make of Veli Pasha and his pursuit of pictures of marble? The provincial governor is most notable because he stands apart from the constellation of actors and scholarship on archaeology in the Ottoman Empire, i.e., the imperial center in foreign antiquarians. Because of his political position, Veli Pasha should be considered as a representative of the state, but it should also be emphasized that he was part of a new class of provincial power holders, which began to emerge throughout the empire in the 18th century, who were outside of the centralized system that groomed the sultan's administrators within the palace court. And in Ottoman historiography, this is referred to as the rise of the Ayan. It remains problematic to equate, therefore, Veli Pasha's interests with those of the Ottoman state. This particular political dynamic may be the reason that Veli Pasha's archaeological activities remain largely invisible in the state Ottoman archives. So remember, Veli Pasha was the one issuing the permissions. He wouldn't have written to Istanbul to give himself permission. Veli Pasha's interest in archaeology seems to have been born in direct response to the arrival of European travelers such as Lord Elgin. Unlike the indigenous archaeologies of non-elite locals, which clearly predate such foreign initiatives, Veli Pasha appears to have only been turned on to his new hobby in conjunction with his European interlocutors. Considering how assiduously the governor kept track of the movements of foreigners in his territory, it is very likely that he was aware of Lord Elgin's initial excavation activities in Mycenae. As outlined earlier, it was in 1810 that Veli Pasha decided to try his own hand at digging up ancient sculpture. It is this jump from bystander to active participant that is the most interesting moment in the case of Veli Pasha, when he fully exploited what could be considered his archaeological agency. Bound up within this term, agency, is an acknowledgement of the fact that the governor, by virtue of his political position, was not subject to the same constrictions of physical mobility and funding that confronted his European visitors at every turn. This being said, there is no question that the governor was in part motivated by monetary considerations. Historians have claimed that both Ali and Veli Pasha were, in their own time, some of the greatest private landowners in the empire. With this enormous and complex economic machine operating in the background, both father and son naturally remained alert to all potential avenues of financial gain. The hunt for antiquities in the Ottoman Empire could at least in part be ascribed to an awareness that there was a market emerging for such objects, where sculptures became a valued commodity. Remember that in the sculptures from Bassi were set up for an open auction in Zakynthos, which I would say constitutes a market. In the case of Bassi in particular, Veli Pasha approached the foreign request for permission to excavate as a business proposition, countering with his own demand to be part of the deal. In the same way that early European antiquarians who traveled to Ottoman Greece were driven both by pecuniary interest and a genuine desire to advance humanistic knowledge, it is reasonable to allow Veli Pasha the same depth of character and mixed motivations in his search for ancient sculpture. Marble sculpture certainly proved their worth as both economic commodity and diplomatic leverage, but it seems that, at least for Veli Pasha, he was equally captivated by the fragments of an ancient civilization practically littered at his feet. It is not difficult to find various details in Western travel accounts or archival material that characterize the governor's abiding interest in the past. Multiple Europeans mention that Veli Pasha had made a trip to Athens around 1810 or 1811, by way of satisfying himself as to what could be the motive of coming so far to see such a place. It appears that he was much struck with the ruins and the effect of the whole. A short time later, Ali Pasha, speaking with another English traveler in Ioannina, asked how long we had left Athens, whether any discoveries had been made there lately by excavations, and mentioned the pleasure which his son Veli Pasha had received by his visit to that beautiful city. Eventually, Veli Pasha's activities in the Morea would inspire his father, Ali Pasha, to take up his own archaeological pursuits further north, most notably at the ancient Roman city of Nicopolis. Besides his frequent consultation with foreign visitors for advice and information regarding antiquity, Veli Pasha also made use of the growing corpus of literature on ancient Greece that was becoming more readily available. William Gell relates that the governor had absolutely undertook to read or caused to be read to him Pausanias, that he might be enabled, as well as the milords, to judge where statues or other precious relics of antiquity might be probably concealed. And when Frederick North visited Veli Pasha in Tripoli, he noted that the governor was at the moment employed in reading a modern Greek translation of Oliver Goldsmith's History of Greece, which was most likely an 1806 translation printed in Vienna by the scholar Dimitrios Alexandridis, who added a section on Byzantium. Veli Pasha had a reputation for being the most cultivated of Ali Pasha's sons. His brother, Muhtar Pasha, another provincial governor, was more interested in military operations and hunting, as we can tell from various accounts. It's notable that the pious endowment for Veli Pasha's congregational mosque complex in Ioannina, which you see to the right, makes provisions for a library, kutipane. Not one of the five mosque complexes built by his father featured such an institution. So he was really the bookish type. To what extent, then, could Veli Pasha be considered singular in his passion for antiquities? While the governor possessed the wealth and political authority to undertake an unusually active interest in unearthing ancient sculpture, he nevertheless could be considered as coming from a culture of Christian notables, many of whom were educated in Central Europe, but returned to centers like Ioannina and Veli Pasha's own court in Thessaly, who at the time were engaging in a kind of hybrid antiquarianism, drawing upon the information brought by foreign travelers while forming their own intellectual tradition based on a classical education. So this is what we were talking about earlier in the first panel about, you know, where are these different centers of Greek education, and one of the centers, one of the major centers, was Ali Pasha's court, Ali Pasha and Veli Pasha's courts in the north. So the flourishing of local elite interests in the ancient past, typically referred to as the Greek Enlightenment, cannot be simply reduced to a burgeoning of Greek nationalism, though that was obviously a big part of it. The case of Veli Pasha emphasizes that this phenomenon was not exclusive to Christians and that there were alternative archaeologies that do not fit into the mold of European universalism or Greek nationalism. In this context, Veli Pasha appears to be the natural result of a complex constellation of different communities, both foreign and local, who each had their own unique relationship with antiquity according to their education and political interests. While both Christians and Muslim villagers often approached ancient ruins, particularly figural sculpture, with a superstitious belief in their apotropaic capabilities, the elite classes held a more academic interest that was informed by a variety of intellectual traditions. So to sum up, we're going to end with the British Museum. In the online database of the British Museum's collection, most archaeological material has some brief information about the excavation of the object. The website credits, for example, the discovery of the sculptures from Bassey to an international group of antiquarians, naming among others Charles Cockerell, who, as I mentioned, was not even present for the excavation. As for the columns for Mycenae, the entry for these objects makes no mention of Veli Pasha, with a section on acquisition only recognizing the donation from Lord Sligo's son in 1905, which indeed happened. Highlighting this kind of discrepancy in how a modern museum presents the record of excavation and acquisition serves to illustrate a wider, it's not a matter of sort of, you know, getting the record straight, but it does serve to illustrate a wider question within the booming field of the history of archaeology, the tendency to forget the role played by local actors in archaeological discovery. As early as 1821, 11 years after Veli Pasha's venture, a French traveler describes the leadership of the excavations at Mycenae as a joint partnership between Lord Sligo and Veli Pasha. By 1904, Veli Pasha had disappeared completely from the story of the column's discovery. Writing to the Board of Trustees, the British Museum keeper, Cecil Sharp, notes that these are evidently the columns which were excavated by the second Marquess of Sligo about 1812 in the so-called Treasury of Atreus. Thus, about a century after the modern discovery of the columns at Mycenae, the precise details of how they came to light had become distorted, with Veli Pasha fading from the scene and Lord Sligo being promoted to excavation director. I do not want to suggest that the elision of Veli Pasha's role in the column's provenance is due to some kind of like malicious intent. I bring up this example more to reflect on the casual assumptions and omissions that often occur when constructing historical narratives about archaeology. The case studies outlined above demonstrate that Veli Pasha cultivated his antiquarian pursuits with an eye to the interests of foreign visitors to his territories, aspiring to locate and amass a collection of stones as well as the milords. Unfortunately, with the available evidence, it is less certain to what extent the governor mobilized these excavations or the display of these finds in his palaces to validate his own political or ethnic claims by forging connections with the past, although his father, Ali Pasha, would eventually generate his own self-image as the new Pyrrhus, the great Hellenistic king of Epirus. And I published on this elsewhere. This is an inscription from the gates of Ioannina, where Ali Pasha says he is like the genetic descendant of Pyrrhus, the marvelous. So we can talk a little bit during the discussion about the difference between intangible versus tangible cultural heritage. At any rate, Veli Pasha has most likely been lost in the history of archaeology because his story fulfills no contemporary narrative of cultural or political identity. Today, what does it mean to anyone that a Muslim governor of an Ottoman province, born in what is now Albania and ruling over what is now part of Greece, took up a love of the classics alongside Lord Elgin or Byron? David Lowenthal has pointed out that what we describe as history is often heritage in disguise. Legends of origin and endurance, of victory and calamity, project the present back, the past forwards. They align us with the forebears whose virtues we share and whose vices we shun. History explores and explains past, grown ever more opaque over time. Heritage clarifies past so as to infuse them with present purposes. It is no secret that the history of archaeology is deeply enmeshed with heritage politics. Moving forward, it is clear that the European encounter with the Ottoman authorities in the Morea, as well as Athens, was much more multifaceted than a meeting between two separate worlds. If we begin to investigate the broader question of what the past meant to the early modern subject of the Ottoman Empire, both elite and non-elite, we will be able to detect previously unknown trajectories for alternative archaeologies. Thank you.